my name is Margot Weller, and today I'll be giving an introduction to the exhibition Small Scale, Big Change, New Architectures of Social Engagement on view upstairs in the third floor Special Exhibitions Gallery. I am a curatorial assistant in the Museum's Department of Architecture and Design and have worked with the show's curator, Andres Lepic, who organized this exhibition. I suppose a few housekeeping notes before I begin. If you could kindly silence your cell phones if you haven't already done so, and please keep any comments or questions until the end. I will reserve some time for discussion. Lastly, I wanted to announce an event that's been organized in conjunction with the exhibition. The program is entitled From the Earth Up, Architecture as a Social Catalyst, and it will run on Thursday, November 11th, beginning at 6 p.m. One of the featured architects in the exhibition, Francis Carré, will be in discussion with documentary filmmaker Haroun Farooqi, and they will address the traditions of brick production and discuss the social issues surrounding construction in Western Africa. You can visit the museum's website for more details about that event, which is again on Thursday, November 11th. Perhaps some of you have seen the installation, parts of which are pictured here. If you haven't, I do encourage you to head upstairs to engage with the models, photographs, video pieces, and so on. The exhibition will be on view until January 3rd. So basically today I will give an overview of the exhibition and the ideas behind it. I will present briefly all of the projects that are included in the exhibition and then go into a little bit more depth onto some of the very kind of complex projects. To begin, Small Scale Big Change explores 11 global architectural projects for underserved communities around the world. These projects have been completed or initiated over the last 10 years. And they are fairly modest, smaller scale projects that attempt to create an outsized impact on their communities and local environments. The projects represent a variety of methods of architectural practice and agency. The architects act sometimes independently or with their firms, and sometimes in conjunction with other groups, be it non-governmental organizations, city governments, or other constituencies. So we did want to present a kind of wide range of this type of architecture. These architects address the functional requirements of their designs, but also aim to have a broader impact on their communities and also become partners in sometimes social, economic, and political transformation in each one of these places. Their architecture is, I guess, reminiscent of some of the ideals of 20th century masters in the beginning, like Le Corbusier. But these architects presented in the exhibition sort of refuse the one-size-fits-all approach of those utopian sort of envisers and instead choose a kind of careful, very pragmatic and acupunctural approach to their work. And in the end, these acupunctural projects were chosen for display to kind of represent the, I guess, potentials that architects can have to orchestrate change and prioritize work that has social impact, but also balances very real concerns of program and also aesthetics. All of these projects are beautiful and innovative on their own. And I suppose just one note to say that, recently I think our Department of Architecture and Design has taken, a kind of look at different types of architecture, firstly in the recent exhibition Home Delivery, Fabricating the Modern Dwelling in 2008, and more recently Rising Current, Projects for New York's Waterfront were kind of attempting to look at perhaps more pragmatic types of architecture, stepping away from the prominently sort of aestheticizing approach of the 20th century. On this slide are thumbnails of each of the 11 projects presented in the exhibition. which we will discuss further. I just wanted to put together this slide, which shows a satellite view of each one of the projects, if only to kind of bring these very far-flung communities closer to our ourselves. And I think that just a perhaps kind of simple note to say that I think access afforded by the internet makes a lot of these places much more accessible to us as visitors, but also creates a kind of platform for communication between architects and NGOs, where these types of communities become much closer. Okay. Just one more thing. So the resulting group of 11 projects is spread across the globe. There are 3 projects in South America, 3 in North America, 2 in Africa, and 1 each in Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. But we were quite careful to select projects in our own sort of backyard, in Los Angeles, in San Diego, in rural Alabama, and also in Paris. So we're presenting the idea that this type of architecture is active in and essential also, not only in the developing world, but in communities more familiar to us. So in selecting projects for inclusion, Andres, the show's curator, wanted to present a real cross-section of what this type of architecture can look like. So from the most rural communities to the most urban, from architects for whom this is the predominant type of architecture they're engaging with, and also for architects for whom this is a type of architecture they engage in a balanced way with more conventional projects. Okay, so to begin, this is a project in Burkina Faso in a small village called Gando, and it's a school built by an architect, Dubero Francis Carré, between 1999 and 2001. And the project is of interest to us, I think, because of its kind of the architectural innovation, very simple but very pragmatic architecture that the architect brought kind of from his education in Berlin and back to his community. The steel truss roof separated from the ceiling provides a cooler climate in the interior classrooms. All of the materials used in the construction of this project were on site. So the bricks are made of the local earth with a small admixture of cement. No heavy machinery was used in its construction. So in building this project, the architect trained the community to create the building, and in that, you know, becomes a kind of closer relationship with the community and its building. This is a school in Rudrapur, a small village in Bangladesh, built by an Austrian architect named Anna Herringer and her partner Eike Roswag. The school was built between 2004 and 2006 and employs a similar kind of construction technique to the school in Burkina Faso, but instead here we have rammed earth walls, which are made of a mixture of earth, of straw, and a few other sort of materials. On the second floor of the building is a very light, airy lattice work of bamboo. And again, here, no heavy machinery was used in the school's construction. You see a similar overhanging roof to protect from heavy rains and wind, and the sun. And the resulting school is actually 2 floors, which is quite different from the rest of the architecture in the area. The architect was quite keen on introducing this slightly more urban typology to this very rural community, because Bangladesh is one of the most densely populated countries in the world. And in introducing this idea of 2-floor construction, maintaining the very local kind of construction techniques, she introduces an idea of, you know, kind of creating more density and, you know, thusly leaving more land for agricultural use. This is a house called the 20K House. This particular iteration is the eighth in the project. I will explain this one further in a bit. It's located in New Bern, Alabama, and built by some students out of the Rural Studio. This is another housing project in Iquique, a city in the northern desert area of Chile, built between 2003 and 2005 by an organization called Elemental. This slide shows three color studies for a housing project in Lebanon in a coastal city called Tyra, and it's built by an architecture firm led by the architect Hashim Sarkis. Hashim works not only in Lebanon, but also out of Cambridge, Massachusetts. This was a housing project for a group of fishermen, of Lebanese fishermen who had been living in very unsatisfactory conditions in the city's sort of historical coastal area, and who basically created a kind of organization among themselves, a cooperative, and linked with various different NGOs, and also with Hashim to create this housing complex, which basically attempts to kind of mitigate the displacement of their community outside of the city and in an area kind of peppered by ad hoc development. The architect was quite keen on creating a central courtyard, not quite visible in this slide, to create a kind of more insular community. The slides here show different color studies. The architect kind of ran out of money towards the end of construction and decided to, instead of a stenciled frieze sort of outer layer, to paint the project. And I think the results, which you can see upstairs, are quite engaging. This is a school in Los Angeles called Inner City Arts, and it was built by Michael Maltzen, an architect based in Los Angeles also, between the years of 1993 and 2008. The school was built in over a series of three construction phases, the last of which ended very recently. And the school started off as an answer to the limited number of arts classes provided by California public schools. The school is located in a part of Los Angeles known as Skid Row, and it serves a population of children who are among the city's poorest. But the school, I think, is a kind of really exciting, sort of very optimistic community in a very sort of sad area of the city. The architect decided to paint the complex white, which you can see very clearly in this wonderful photo. And in so doing, I think he makes a very sort of assertive statement that this school is here to stay and here to kind of proliferate and become an exciting and optimistic answer to the sort of poverty, localized poverty. I think the white also makes a nice background for the children's very colorful and exciting artwork. This is a project by an architect named Teddy Cruz, who's based in San Diego, California. And it's a project located in San Isidro, just north of the Tijuana border. In this project, Teddy collaborated closely with a non-governmental organization called Casa Familiar, who works exclusively with the community of San Isidro, which is mostly composed of immigrant families, to kind of consider the ideas of density and housing in a community sort of set up as a Levittown, but now used much, much differently, and to kind of reconsider issues of density in this type of immigrant community. The project is soon to be under construction and consists of two very multi-use but housing projects called Living Rooms at the Border on the left side of the screen and Senior Housing with Child Care on the right side. This is a project in Port Elizabeth in a township called Red Location. in the country of South Africa. It's called the Red Location Museum of Struggle. And this project, built by a South African firm, Noera Wolf Architects, is the first completed portion of a larger master plan for this area. And it's an apartheid museum, and it will be a kind of centerpiece of this larger master plan, which will include an art gallery, music school, and other amenities directly into the township. This project, called Manguinos Complex in Rio de Janeiro by architect Jorge Mario Jaregui, is also ongoing. And with this project, the architect does sort of unthinkable thing of raising a railway line to connect all sorts of different disconnected neighborhoods or favelas. And in so doing, he attempts to create, or is creating, this park underneath, which he calls the Rambla, like in Barcelona, where through which these communities can kind of interact. And I guess in that kind of gesture, which is an engineering feat, he tries to mitigate the kind of disconnection and lack of amenities that these folks have had access to. This, another very large-scale project, is in Caracas, Venezuela, and is a metro cable system to also connect one of the city's barrios to the formal city. So the portion on the upper half of the slide is the barrio, the slum, and you can see a line that connects it to the metro system. So the map is basically bisected by one of the main thoroughfares, and that thoroughfare also bisects the formal and informal city. But of course, the people who live on the upper part of the map, almost all of them commute to the city for work. So with this metro cable system, which I will show you images of soon, the architects attempt to again connect these folks with the rest of the city. And lastly, this is a project in Paris, and it's called the Transformation of Tourbois-le-Pretz. And it's been, this project is also ongoing and set to complete next year, and built by architects Anne Lacaton, Jean-Philippe Vassal, and Frédéric Drouot. And they were winners of a 2005 competition sponsored by the city to address the housing tower you see on the left. The rendering on the right is their solution, which is in progress right now. And basically, these architects have long been addressing the idea of the adaptive reuse of existing structures instead of their demolition. And they have very successfully proven that instead of demolishing and building from scratch, which is often much more expensive, that one can address existing buildings, then the results are much more environmentally friendly and often, again, less expensive, but also they don't disrupt existing social networks, existing families and their homes. So actually this project, whose construction is ongoing, hasn't forced anyone to move out of their apartment. Okay, very lastly is a small section and kind of annexed upstairs in the gallery that explores three internet-based networks or initiatives that, again, as I was sort of mentioning before, that attempt to connect architects with architects, architects with NGOs, and to kind of catalog the type of architecture that those 11 folks represent. And there's a wide variety of architecture projects presented on these platforms, but through kind of access to these ideas, the hope is that, you know, ideas aren't repeated or solutions aren't, or questions can be answered and discussions promoted. And I guess one of the other things that particularly the Open Architecture Network does is provide the kind of open source design. So architects can share actual plans with other organizations, and those can later be kind of customized for other sites and specific requirements. Okay, so these are the projects that I will attempt to kind of go into more depth in the remaining amount of time. So back to Alabama. This is a place that I was actually fortunate enough to visit. The Rural Studio has been in operation since 1993. It was founded as a kind of satellite school for Auburn University. It's 3 hours west of there in an extremely rural area in western Alabama. And the school, which is a design-build program, so undergraduate students go to this school to design projects and actually build them. So it's this kind of consummate education of the architect, and one that not every architecture student has access to. And they're also working in a community that has very actual and real needs for these types of interventions. So the Rural Studio has built some 100 houses, community centers, sports facilities, and other various and sundry projects. But many of them in its beginnings were more poetic, more sculptural projects, often using discarded materials, recycled materials, and that kind of thing. This project is a bit of a departure from the rest of their work in that the Rural Studio is attempting to create a kind of prototype, a viable alternative to low-income rural housing. And so this project has a very strict budget, has a very strict timeline, things that are somewhat absent from the other projects they engage in. The 20K house project has been ongoing since 2005. I think the Rural Studio is a fairly unique place in that they have access to a regenerating pool of students, and also they have the time to engage in these types of really kind of important queries. So basically, this is an area that is very impoverished. There are more sort of poor folks here than in many other places around the United States. But the main thing that this project addresses is the fact that the best sort of alternative, best option for low-income housing that these folks have is the mobile home, is a trailer whose value and quality depreciates almost immediately, like any other car would. And so the Rural Studio is attempting to create an alternative. So basically, since 2005, they have created 9 versions of the $20,000 house. The focus of our presentation is Dave's house, the 8th iteration on the lower left. But one of the great things about this project is, again, the access that the students have to the results of their predecessors' research and building. So basically, you know, many of these houses have come close to answering the project's prompts, which are to build a house for $20,000. It's meant to be kind of split in $12,500 for materials, $7,500 for labor costs. Of course, in developing the project, those don't necessarily exist, but this is ultimately meant to be rolled out by local contractors. And that the house also should be able to be built in 3 weeks' time. So each detail of these houses is fastidiously considered, and each piece of material, piece of wood, of sheeting, and so on and so forth, is extremely carefully considered. So the very simple design of Dave's house, you can imagine, is perhaps more efficient and more cost-effective than some of the more fanciful designs, which, you know, indeed went over budget or over construction time. So basically, the student groups have, which are three students and one instructor have 8 months to design these this home and 3 weeks to build it. The eighth iteration built for this resident on the right, Dave, is a very simple, almost shotgun house, and the front of which is attached this beautiful white pine porch. The students actually built a mock-up of the porch on site, on the site of their school, to again very carefully kind of consider and mock up in one-to-one the details and the construction, and you know, to see if this was their design was in fact good and smart enough. They deconstructed the mock-up and used the materials in the actual house. You'll see that, one of the motivating ideas was to create high ceilings and also good ventilation. So having punched out windows, you know, costs money and takes time to do. Each of these aspects, which are sort of we might take for granted, are really kind of reduced to the most elemental. And the house has 10-foot ceilings. It's about between 500 and 600 square feet, extremely pleasant inside, costs Dave some $36 a month year-round for utilities. Okay. So moving on to this other housing project, which is in Chile, Elemental, which is again firm behind this project, is quite unique. It's an organization of architects, of social workers, of artists who are in collaboration with the Catholic University in Santiago, and also with OPEC, which is the largest oil company in Chile. So it's actually a for-profit organization. And basically what they are trying to do is kind of re-situate low-income housing as an entrepreneurial opportunity rather than an expense to be borne by the state, and a kind of unsavory one as well. So basically in 2003, the architects were given a prompt by the government of Chile to build houses, or rather apartments, for 100 families for $7,500 over a half hectare site. So a seemingly impossible prompt. How do you build a reasonable, a decent, and dignified house for that little amount of money? So basically they realized that that little amount of money could only yield a half of a house. And they, you know, after sort of going through various existing typologies, you know, the standalone house, the row house, and they basically figured out that they couldn't accommodate that number, you know, that 100 set of families, and that they would have to search for a different typology. They briefly explored the idea of a high rise, but you know, they say that the residents threatened a hunger strike if that was the ultimate solution. This was a parcel in the center of the city. So one of the very crucial components was to try to figure out a solution that would avoid displacing anybody, or without, you know, so that all of these families could stay where they had been for the last 30 or so years. So again, the architects kind of figured out that that small sum, which was to cover the cost of infrastructure, of land, and also of each house, was only sort of sufficient for half of a house. But what they wanted to focus on was the actual ownership of the land, so that with the with that sum, each family could kind of own something. So they decided indeed to create half of a house. I'll go back to that. So you see this kind of modular outline that they created. These houses are made of reinforced concrete, stabilized for earthquakes, and they basically have direct access for each of the families. There are lower floor houses, and on top of them are duplexes. And each family was given a half of a house into which they could build as their income and time allowed. So basically, the voids are equally sized to that which was built. The architects built the sort of half of the house that was, more difficult to build for in the beginning, so that which contained plumbing, electricity, so on. And then the voids between are sized to accommodate standard-sized construction materials, and the architects created sort of a series of workshops to discuss ways to kind of enter into these gaps. So it's a more customizable option. The residents who need build more bedrooms can do so, or configure their apartments as they see fit. This slide shows on the upper right an interior of the very spare, very Spartan initial condition of the house, and then you see on the bottom the very lively kind of customized home built by one of the residents. On the upper left of this slide is a picture of a model, one of these workshops where like actual models and other sort of pedagogical tools were used to help residents envision their future homes. You can see on view in the exhibition gallery a set of sort of paper models that the architects ultimately developed to give to residents to kind of color and customize in anticipation of their new homes, and also as a tool to sort of think about the neighborhood aesthetic. So having kind of smaller clusters of residents discuss, how, if they were to kind of standardize finish materials and all of that. But one of the nicest things I think about this project is that the architecture sort of recedes, and that in, the ultimate, the finished product becomes much more colorful and lively. The residents provide their own kind of texture to each of their homes. Okay, so yet another housing project, this time in Paris. And again, this was the existing housing tower that architects Anne Lacaton, Jean-Philippe Vassal, and Frédéric Drouot were addressing. The tower seen on the far left was built in 1961 by an architect, Raymond Lopez, and was once renovated in 1991. But this tower, not unlike some of its peers, was often criticized for being cramped, for having kind of disorganized communal space, for and also in particular in Paris, for being the centers of some of the kind of racial and uprisings over the last 20 or so years. So basically in 2005, the city of Paris sponsored a competition that these architects won to rethink this one particular building, and included in the prompt was the specification that it couldn't be demolished. And the architects kind of envision a system that would allow more space and more light for each apartment. So you see on the top image of kind of cramped, restricted view, and then in the second image, the facade is sort of peeled off, and in the third, a balcony is sort of plugged on. So I think particularly in this location on the Ring Road of Paris, where the building is separated by innumerable highway lanes, that there's this kind of psychological barrier between the residents and the city, and the view is regained. So I suppose that's a kind of start. On the right side of this slide, you see two models that are on view upstairs, the center of which is the kind of existing condition of the house of the tower, with these small balconies that are prefabricated, getting attached by a small crane. And on the right side, you see the realized project. So the construction for this project takes place in sort of three phases, the first of which is a kind of peeling off the exterior facade. Then these prefabricated balconies are plugged in, and then various changes are made to the interior apartments. The architects worked closely with the apartment's residents. The apartment is 16 stories tall with about 96 apartments, and they worked closely with them to develop different interior configurations that might be more suited to contemporary living styles. So whereas there were some three or four apartment layouts when the apartment building was designed, they created through, you know, sort of deconstruction or deleting of interior walls, many more configurations that were more suitable to these families. So basically, over the course of construction, which began just a little while ago, a year or so ago, and is to be finished by sometime in 2011, the architects used an existing set of about 8 vacant apartments to sort of rearrange and work with so that no resident needed to be displaced. Residents could actually stay in their apartments during construction, but if they so chose, they could move into one of these vacant apartments while these reconfigurations were going on. In this sort of schematic, you see on the first slide the literal kind of cutting of the exterior facade, more opaque facade, and the addition of these glass walls. Another sort of point behind this project is that the ultimate sort of energy costs behind the building are actually lower because of the advanced kind of insulation that the new exterior facade provides. So in that top schematic, you see the sort of regaining of the view. In the second slide, the addition of a balcony. And in the third, you can see the idea of this sort of editing of the interiors. In that top view is the sort of suggestion that not only were they to work on the interior apartments, but also on the communal spaces. This particular building had a very kind of unsavory entryway that in which you had to kind of go down the stairs before going upstairs. And so that was reconfigured and addressed. And also the elevator system sort of went to each floor, and then there was a kind of half floor that residents would have to use a staircase to access. So these things were also considered, and on the bottom schematic you see the sort of basement area, which was edited to include bicycle storage, laundry facilities, and that kind of thing. So in all of this is a really kind of nice and optimistic suggestion that these low-income housing towers have the capability of becoming really nice and gracious facilities for the city's poorest, and I think has wide implications on you know, existing buildings in New York City, in Berlin, in Chicago, and all over the place, that, you know, demolition perhaps isn't the answer and perhaps isn't, you know, the best option, particularly when you want to maintain these existing, you know, and perhaps improve existing social networks. This is an image of one of the interiors and a kind of rendering of the ultimate interior. Okay, so I will talk briefly about this metro cable system in Caracas. Basically, this is an overview of the area, and you see that the city is in a valley, and the city's poorest have been pushed onto these hills on the right. The architects Alfredo Brillenberg and Hubert Klumpner of Urban Think Tank wanted to address these issues in the barrios of Caracas and to create a way to maintain or to actually improve access for the residents to the formal city, but they were insistent that this would not include cars, that the actual paving of streets and sort of reorganization of these very dense communities would result in the displacement of many more people than a cable car would ultimately do. So basically, they presented their proposal to the city government. This is, of course, a project that couldn't be done by an architect on his own, and ultimately got the approval of the President Hugo Chavez, and the project was kind of translated and re-sort of organized, but has actually been, the first stage of which has actually been realized. There is a set of 5 cable car stations, 3 of which are in the hills, and they connect to the city's metro system. They change what was once a kind of 39-story climb to a, you know, 5 or 6 minute cable car ride. The cable car opened in January of this past year, and is free at the moment, but will soon be some 50% of the cost of a ride on the bus. So it is meant to be very affordable and to again provide access for the these folks to the formal city. Integrated also into this project is a set of cultural and other facilities that the architects are in they're developing at this moment. This project for a vertical gymnasium, something that they've already built elsewhere in the city, is ongoing, and these are what they call plug-in buildings, where they imagine plugging in a kind of social, cultural, whatever, building into adjacent to each station, so to kind of infiltrate with various amenities the existing fabric of the barrio. So this project is for a vertical gymnasium, so a kind of suburban typology urbanized vertically, and where sports fields are kind of layered on top of each other. And also with this project, they imagine kind of doing very small-scale interventions, from dry toilets to small prefabricated stairways, so that the entire fabric of the neighborhood is kind of reconsidered and addressed. Also integrated in this project is a collaboration with a graphic designer named Rudy Bauer, who has been working with Urban Think Tank on all sorts of levels to create some color and integrated sort of signage to this project. And one sort of interesting anecdote is that his designs for the cable car, which you can kind of see in the center left of this image, were kind of translated by the city to become these red, very propagandistic capsules. So some of these sort of colorful and whimsical ideas have been translated, I guess. Okay, and I guess lastly, to finish up so there's time for questions, this is a very complex project by Teddy Cruz. And basically, Teddy Cruz works at the border region between San Diego and Tijuana and learns from both sides. He actively researches and sort of observes the conditions on both sides of the border, and is actively observing the kind of pixelation in this image that's existent in Tijuana as it kind of infiltrates the U.S. border. And his particular site is a city called San Isidro, which San Diego actually incorporates, but is mostly comprised of immigrant residents. And what Teddy wants to do is kind of collaborate with all of these different constituencies from economic and folks to nonprofit organizations and so on, to kind of choreograph the best and most suitable intervention. And so what he does is and what he has done in this project that hasn't yet broken ground, is to reconsider zoning rules more appropriate to the city of San Isidro. So how can this community, which is living in a way much different from some of its neighbors in San Diego, have rules more appropriate to those conditions. The housing projects are living rooms at the border, which would incorporate a community center for Casa Familiar and senior housing with childcare. So that's the project on the upper portion of this slide, which is a series of 13 granny flats. So those fingers kind of interweave and create little apartments for grandmothers and also small lofts for their grandchildren, because I suppose in this area is a kind of community where the grandmothers are often in custody of their grandchildren. And the outermost stripe is a child care center that they all kind of co-manage. Throughout these two projects is an idea of the kind of combination between very specifically programmed spaces, housing, community centers, all of that, but with very ambiguously programmed ones. So space for all sorts of things to happen. This diagram on the bottom shows a kind of time use scenario for this what Teddy calls a sort of social service infrastructure, on top of which is placed housing. So in that space below can happen any number of things, from a farmer's market to, you know, a kind of community meeting to X, Y, and Z. He also envisions the plan not only statically in the way that we would normally address or address plans on the upper left, but also dynamically, the idea of a plan or a series of buildings used actively and dynamically. So I guess maybe that's where I will end, so that in case you have any questions, we might not go too over time. So thank you. Yes.
Thank you. That was a great presentation. I just was curious about the cooperation in these projects. I mean, because we all know the layers that have to, the city government has to go through to get a project built in New York. Is full cooperation? I mean, do they have the same bureaucracies? I assume they do.
Of course. Okay, so the question is about levels of cooperation or participation in each of these projects. And I think there is a range. I think there, among these projects, are a variety of different methods imposed by the architects, whether it is collaborating directly with the city or with the help of a non-governmental organization, or reconsidering ideas of zoning. So that becomes the kind of vehicle for a different and new typology. In some of these instances, particularly in the more rural and very sort of small interventions, like in Burkina Faso or in Bangladesh, there is the kind of complete cooperation and participation with the community where they are actually the construction workers. In this project, in South Africa, there is a very sort of active and vocal community organization in the township of Red Location, because, you know, for so long there are these promises of improvement or of reconstruction or whatever it might be in the township, and so how to make this intervention more successful. So they collaborated very closely with the architect, and in fact insisted that the construction process would include a rotating set of unskilled workers. So the contractor was tasked with training a new set of unskilled workers every 3 weeks over the course of construction. So something that certainly slowed down the process, but one that, you know, creates a more direct kind of connection between the project and its resident and local residents. Exactly. And I think, you know, particularly, I think that type of, or sort of new types of participation are really present in this project, where not only from the kind of typology of the, and the kind of architecture of the building, but also the process in which it's constructed is a very kind of concerted effort to include and involve and sort of interact with the community. And this is a project, you know, which engages directly in the community with the history of apartheid in a very kind of contemplative way. So anyway, all right. Yes.
In most of these things that you've just shown us. Who initiates the idea?
Well, I think we tried to kind of present a range. For most of these projects, the architects themselves initiate the idea, but in some of them, with the example of the art school in Los Angeles, it's a kind of fortuitous sort of meeting between, you know, the organization and the architect. And once the architect is excited and engaged with the idea, there are sometimes, you know, 15-year-long kind of collaborations. So I think, you know, for some of these projects, or for most of them, you need that type of collaboration. But the architect, you know, in the case of the school in Burkina Faso, there's this idea of the architect having an idea and going out and doing it himself. That's not always so practical in some of these larger or more complex communities.
Also, I have another question regarding the gapped house.
Yeah.
Which I thought was fascinating. But were people who build beyond that, were they mandated to stay within certain codes and things like that?
I don't know if they were mandated to stay within certain codes, but I think it was to stay within the void. So I think it's not necessarily... I think in a lot of these places, you know, we have... New York City is so sort of... plagued by its building codes. In many of these places, those types of things don't exist or aren't quite as restricting. So I think within this project, yes, they were meant to stay within that space, partly because, you know, they wanted a residency that they could expand into with the kind of you know, part of the reason they were so disinterested in a high-rise building is how can you expand? You can expand upwards, but you can't expand out. You know, if you're on the third of the eighth floor, like, where do you go? Likewise, the expansion opportunities in a row house are more disorganized. So this is a kind of opportunity for organized expansion.
So they get the half house, and the rest of it is their space to do which they want.
Yes.
So they have the right for that space.
Yes, exactly. Are there any other questions? Yes.
Did you find the projects off the three internet sites that you mentioned?
No, although the question is about, I guess, how we found or discovered these projects and if they were on those three networks that I mentioned. Some of them are included on these those internet networks, the 1% Open Architecture Network and Urban Inform, but that wasn't necessarily our source. I think that with this exhibition, we're trying to get this type of architecture a kind of broader lens. But many of these projects have been published in smaller or even larger publications like Domus or Architectural Record or some other kind of niche publications. But many of them have been highly lauded. The two projects I presented first, the schools in Bangladesh and in Burkina Faso, won the Aga Khan Award for Architecture, which is sort of the Pritzker Prize in the Muslim architectural world. Many of these projects have been praised and prized and so on and so forth. So we, you know, they have popped up all over the place. Is that it? Yes. Yes.
Were those specifically constructed for just that kind of climate, or could the same idea work
elsewhere?
More northern region?
Well, I guess okay. So the question is about the sort of climate specificity of the 20K house in Alabama, and I think they're certainly suited for that climate insofar as there is no air conditioning and the heating is provided only by the wood burning stove. So the applicability is not so wide-reaching, but I think that it certainly could be edited or whatever for other conditions, but their purpose is to create a house unique for those conditions in western Alabama.
Speaking to that, is the lack of a real foundation that built up on...
There is a foundation. It's a pier foundation. So I guess there are maybe eight concrete pilasters on top of which the house is built. So that makes construction a lot more fast, but it doesn't weaken the foundation. Okay. Thank you.